We're going to talk about a ritual tonight, by special request of an expert ritualist. But we're not going to talk about particular rituals that you may know of in your various organizations, churches, chapels, synagogues, etc. We're going to talk about the principle of ritual and what it is about, what it was devised for originally. And to do that, we have to go back about 500,000 years. It's not difficult in the imagination. I want you to go back to a period when human beings were living together and had not yet separated from each other. They had not spread out, so there was no real sense of alienation. The type of this relationship is seen in the child in utero. Imagine the baby inside the mother, and the energy of the child and the energy of the mother are interpenetrating. What the mother feels, the child feels, and when the child feels something, the mother feels it. If the child moves, the mother feels the movement. If the mother moves, the child feels the movement. I want you to think about the psychology of the child in utero and of the mother. We'll have a few examples from members of the audience, audience participation, mothers of the world unite, and I want you to tell me something about those of you who had babies, legitimate or otherwise, how you felt when you first knew that you were pregnant. Any offers? Excited. Who said that? You felt excited. What were you excited about?
Like a flower going to open.
Excitement like a flower going to open. Any other offers from pregnant ladies?
Trapped.
We have to remember that there are always a pair of opposites in any proposition. There's an interesting, exciting aspect, and there is a frightening aspect. Whenever you get something, you always get a pair of opposites, because there are responsibilities, there are rights. There are rights and privileges. And we have to remember this thoroughly, so that's what we're going to talk about next. When the woman first finds herself enlarging, can you imagine what the first woman felt like before she actually delivered herself of this mysterious cause of the enlargement? Ladies, what would the first woman feel like? She feels exactly like the first time a woman has a child and hasn't had one yet. She's seen some outside, but she doesn't know that she can do it, does she? She's not certain. I have actually seen ladies with what are called wind children in the business, where they go up, then they go down again. Nothing happens. Now, how did the first woman feel when she found herself enlarging and then she felt kicking inside her? How did she feel? Frightened. Gross? What does gross mean in that context? Large and solid. She was actually becoming packed with something or other. Her organs were being displaced inside. Something was happening and she could feel movement. What would she think the movement was? Crocodiles? Wild rhinoceroses wandered in and trapped? Or something else? God? Good idea. A god was about to be born. If we go back a long way, we actually find this is a real belief. There are a lot of primitive people. And it still exists in Yiddish Amamas. My son is a god. You know about this. It's called the Messianic Complex. Every Jewish boy is a Messiah. It wasn't a new idea in Moses' day. It was a very old idea. We go back 6,000 years. That looks a long time from now, but it's nothing at all compared with 500,000 years ago. When this process occurred inside, the psychological state of the woman who was not yet aware of what it was that was inside, and whether it would simply mean she would expand, or whether at some point she would burst, or whether there would be some kind of mysterious provision and there would emerge a new life. And what happened in the old days, before men, with their empirical investigations, knew anything about it, what happened to a woman when she was pregnant, and no other woman had been pregnant in her presence, and the men knew nothing about it? What did she do? Where did she go? What would you do?
Hide.
Yes? This is very important, isn't it? Because there is a tendency, when any really important biological process occurs, to hide. Because you don't know what is going to happen. It could be something that would turn the other beings against you, or for you, and you don't know. So you're ambiguous about it. Now, you hide, that's part of it. There is a secret, something about it. And we find this secrecy running later on through history, through all rituals, and something kept secret, in case. Even today, in case. Because when a woman is pregnant, she doesn't know what she's going to deliver, whether it's going to be an antelope or a businessman. It could be anything. That's right, her business. Personal, private, and very, very internalized. Right? When we go back in this way, in the imagination, we are indulging in a piece of creative imaginative play, and we find that what we are actually doing is dredging up from the depths of the unconscious by feeling what might have occurred. Now, no being knows anything other than the modalities of its own being, does it? Can it know anything other than the modalities of its own being? You can't. I can't know a light over there. I can only know the impact of something on my retina, which I call light. If I project it over there and focus and converge my two eyes on it to get a distance, I'm really doing a trick on myself. I'm projecting it. The real sensation there is in some organ inside my head, and I project it. My real processes are internal. They are secret. Nobody can see them. They could infer them from similar behavior externally in me, from something that's happened to them. You can't know anything about somebody else unless you know something about yourself. So the first thing about rights we recognize is that they have two aspects, an inner secret aspect and an outer shown aspect. All the trouble about rights that develops later on, and the wars and the slaughter about them, because all the wars of the world have been about rights of one kind or another, are caused through lack of awareness of the inwardness of the right and too much concentration on the outwardness of the right. Now imagine this situation long ago, when a very simple thing occurred, like a woman becoming pregnant, and a new thing emerged into the world. Now imagine when this child is delivered. Again, what does the woman feel like when this creature emerges from her being? What is her relation to it?
Joy,
closeness, intimacy, great relief, and fear.
It's more than that. It's something of her. It's two in one.
It's something of her.
Yeah.
Well, at least she knows it's come from her body, that it wasn't there before, so she must believe she's had something to do with it. Yeah. Seriously. So there's a oneness there. There is a joy there, providing the thing doesn't immediately turn around and bite your hand off. It's joyful, providing the thing goes well. It could be very frightening if it didn't go well. You always have this ambiguity about it. Now, when this being comes into the world, let's assume that it comes into the world perfectly happily, in a perfectly relaxed way. And then let's assume that another pregnancy occurs later, and there has been fear. There has been, perhaps, death through animal jumping on husband. And this pregnant woman brings forth a child. What is she thinking now? How is she going to take the new child? It will be slightly different, won't it? She may be more tense. The birth may be difficult. Now, from comparison of these two things, the easy and the difficult, came this concept of right. Put RT in your mind as the basis of it. Right. Now the R means the differences, and the T means the crucifixions caused by the differences. This is a base, the base RT, which occurs in ritual, occurs in the word right with a DH in it, and the RITE without the DH. The DH means effort, strength, power. The absence of it means form without power. But the original of it is there are differences, and the differences fixate you, they pin you. Ritual, the right, is concerned with this. How can I fixate in my mind the differences and equate them with the crucifixions? The crucifixions, if you like, are the things that you get pinned on by your own activities. Let the R represent vibration, a differentiator. If you get a bucket of coal and shake it, then the big pieces will come to the top. They come to the top because the little ones fell down. That's very important when you come to consider government. Big men at the top are not big because they climbed up. They are not at the top because they are intelligent. Never make that mistake. They are at the top because the others fell down in the shake. There was a shake, there was a vibration, there was a shock, there was a looseness and a movement. And in that movement, all the little ones fell down. And as a result of this downfalling, there arose the larger pieces that could not fall down through the spaces that were too small for them. So the big ones have arrived at the top because the little ones fell down. And they've fallen down because they were little, perhaps physically, like babies, or because they were afraid, because they had been hurt before, or deliberate downgoing because of consciousness of the responsibility of going up. There could be a variety of reasons for going down. The important thing is to remember the ones on top are there because the others moved down. When you go home, shake your bucket of coal. If you've got an electric fire, shake that, and you won't get the same result. Unplug, please, before doing exercise. Now, if we look at this word right, the RT, every single act that you do creates a difference in you. You cannot do an act, even what you call the same act, twice in the same way. The reason is, when you do an act, you change the distribution of energy in your body. You change the distribution of nervous energy. You change the synaptic knitting in the ends where the sparks jump, where the nervous impulse jumps over the gaps. The gaps change. They become easier to jump. You condition yourself by the things you do. This is the essential of ritual. When you do something, you condition yourself. That is to say, you pin yourself, you crucify yourself. So you write T for the little cross, R for the thing you did that produced the difference. Now, if we take this RT and reverse it, we get TR. This is the basis of Torah, of law. Law is repetition. There is no law unless the act is repeated. If an act occurred once, uniquely, and never occurred again, it could not constitute a law. A law means some kind of behavior pattern, some way of energy operating that repeats itself often enough to be recognized. It must happen at least twice. And you'd have to be very sharp to see that it had happened twice if it only happened twice. If it happened three times, it's a bit better to recognize, and after 3,000 million, then it is fairly easy to recognize the form of the repetition. So Torah, law, rota, rotation, repetition, and ritual, the rite, are really the same word disguised, manipulated to aid meditation. Now let's think about this very carefully. When you do something, no matter what it is, you are conditioning yourself, you're conditioning your organism. Using the hand on your little finger, you mentally put physical body. If you do something, you condition your physical body. If my friend Gerhardt undertakes to do a little exercise of balling up, and he lands on the floor in his exercise, he conditions his body. Did you condition your body on Friday, big girl? Yes. Yes. Is Andrew Freeman about the place? Yes. Did you condition yours a bit?
Yes.
Yeah. You did a similar exercise on Tuesday, didn't you?
Yes.
Haven't you found that through doing it on Tuesday, on the Friday you approached it with not quite the same innocence that you did on the Tuesday, and that something had happened to your body, hadn't it? So that you actually had a modification of your physical body's behavior from a simple little exercise. One little exercise, that's the R in the ritual, had established, had pinned itself in the body, had crucified itself, and in the process it had modified the body, in this case of our two participants. A couple of ladies did a similar exercise, rather more gently, Greta, Margaret, and in the process, what did you derive, Greta? Did you modify yourself in any way?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite a gentle exercise, wasn't it? And although it was gentle, you modified your body in the process. In fact, you cannot act in the same way in the same situation again now, can you? Something has occurred. Now, this something that has occurred and has established itself in your body is the T in rite, in the ritual. The thing that you did, the actual activity, the thing we call the mudra, the posturing gesture, the activity, that thing has altered your body irretrievably. You can never go back, Greta, can you?
No.
You can't get rid of it. If you tried to repress it, you'd be using energy that you weren't using before.
It would be impossible to repress it because the feeling has been so intense since doing it that if I was to repress it again, I know it would be totally different.
Well, supposing we actually gave you a drug. I've got one in my pocket here actually now. I could give you a little pill and you would completely forget that exercise.
The body
doesn't. And as soon as the drug wears off, up it comes again. Also, in trying to make you forget in this way, we've added something to you that you didn't have before. So again, the fact that you did the exercise has committed you to a reactivity to a new situation in a new way, hasn't it?
Yes.
So, engram, grain, grind, push in, nail in. The R is the difference, the differentiation of your body, basically. And the T is the fixation in that body of the record of the act. So the T is the little cross, the crucifixion. Terminal letter T in the Hebrew alphabet, the Tau, or Tav, that letter means a cross. It doesn't look like a cross in the Hebrew. It looks like two other letters. But it is a cross. And originally it was a cross. Now, in the particular form in the Hebrew, the two letters that compose that letter are a resh and a vav. That is to say, a differentiating, vibrating energy and a nail. Vav is symbolically, in the Hebrew language, in any good Hebrew lexicon, a nail, a hook, something that fixates you. The resh means your tongue, that which enables you to talk, to differentiate. So in that one letter, we've already got the same concept. Now let's examine this concept, because this particular letter tells you something. The human tongue, that's the resh, and the vav, the nail, the hook, is a euphemism for the male organ, for sexual drive. Now, the human tongue rules the sexual drive. And we're going to follow this through this discussion of ritual. We're going to go right back to the beginning. There is a woman. How does she become pregnant? How does the first woman become pregnant? Well, she is what is called inseminated. And in the process, a difference is introduced into her. Something happens, an energy comes into contact with an inner energy that she has, and as a result, a process occurs in her, a genital process, a genital relation, the gen part means generate, and this has imposed on her a very peculiar thing, a relationship which in primitive languages would be called a dual relationship. There is now not one me, but two. We'll assume that Daddy's gone on hunting, not knowing anything about it, and he followed a rabbit to get its skin to make the baby bunting, etc., etc. He's gone away like a good Greek hero, and he's forgotten about this woman because he saw something terribly interesting and chased it. And he ran from wherever he was in the Babylon Euphrates site up into the Arctic Circle. And he found the sun didn't set up there at the time. So he made a note of that and then sailed over the ocean and discovered America long before Columbus. But he forgot all about his commitments. In fact, actually, he never had a commitment in our modern sense. He fell into a situation. So there is this lady, and she now has this new God. Now, God is an equation. God is good. The word God and good are the same word. You stretch out the O in the middle in English. The Gott ist gut in German is the same thing. And this idea, whatever you worship, whatever you are prepared to praise, must be for you a good. If it's not a good, it's not worth praising. If it isn't worth praising, it's not a God. The highest, the supreme good is called God. If you want a simple definition from a theologian about what God is, he is the supreme good. Notice he's got to be supreme. We don't say he's the most inferior, horrible, deficient, inefficient, nincompoop. We say he's omniscient, he's omnipotent, he's omnipresent, he can do anything and everything, and simultaneously we can't get at him because he's invisible. Now, these are the ideals for the human mind to attain to. God is good. That means to say that whatever the word God means or whatever the word good means, they both refer to the same fact, to power, to intelligence, to presence. Power, intelligence, presence. Put those three together inside your body. You have power. Move a hand to prove it. Don't take it on trust. Don't keep it intellectually. Move something. You've got something. Move it. You've got power, presence. If you don't move your body, that's the mudra, you will not get the message. It's a horrible truth. You know, modern, especially Western audience, if you say something and ask them to do something, they feel embarrassed. You know, scratch the end of your nose like that. Don't be shy. How many of you can make yourself do it? And how many of you feel, I can't do that, it embarrasses me? Is it true? Did you all go like this? I saw one or two people that didn't. Now, why not? If you don't do it, you don't get the same benefit as if you did do it. This is the whole meaning of the mudra, mantra, yantra, tantra. That is to say, if you wish to extend your powers, you must do it. Thought it was too easy? No, they didn't. There's an unconscious belief that somebody might look at them and see they didn't do it right. True. You see, we have millions of years of people, long before we were in condensed growth bodies, doing things unright. That is, not RT conscious. You do something and you immediately are fixated. I know a fellow, I don't know whether I'm going to discuss somebody tonight. It's possible. I won't use any rude words. I'll tell you what actually happened. A man had his finger up his nose in a cinema. Quietly in the dark. He believed he was unseen. And suddenly his wife's elbow went up his elbow. This actually occurred. Up shot the nail, high, and blood poured all over his new suit. Now, I want you to imagine that never again in the cinema when with the wife did he put that finger up that nose. Never again when he put a finger up his nose anywhere did he do it with a woman on the same side. Okay? I'm talking essential ritual sense now. You might think it's a joke. It isn't a joke. It's very serious. Because it actually scarred him inside and out. Yes? I could tell you other stories. Similar, but I won't. You can make them up as you go along. Your protoplasm is full of them. Right? Now, physical body, if you don't move it, if you don't create a difference in it, you will not become aware of what is hidden in it. There's an infinity of possibilities in the physical body. Do you know what prepping the knob is? It means hitting your sacrum at the back of your head. Can you bend over backwards and knock your sacrum at the back of your head? It's called prepping the knob in the business. They do it in circuses, and they're quite good when they can do it efficiently without too much groaning in public. They have to exercise usually about 4 times a day to keep it up. But it's very interesting when you can do it. And when it's done very easily, the audience doesn't think anything about it. They say something like, she's double-jointed. They think people have double joints when they do that. They don't think it's hard exercise. When you do something with your body, you differentiate your body. Now, I want to remind you to remind yourself that your physicality, your materiality is energy. There is no matter that isn't energy. So if you do something with your body, you're doing something with an energy system. And this energy system will never be the same again in all eternity. You're not just changing your body for a few minutes or for a few years. You're changing your body permanently. But this body of yours is energy. It is a mass of energy. Organized by what? We'll find out by what. On your little finger, put your body. Bend your little finger one way, it's fairly easy. Bend it the other way, it's difficult. There's a right way of treating your little finger. Which way does it bend better?
Forward only.
Forward only. Bend it the same distance backwards now. You'll break it. You've done it before.
No, I haven't actually broken it. I can feel the resistance.
Very good. And you have had ancestors who have been told to keep quiet by breaking their little fingers.
Yeah? Yes.
A method I used to use with my little sister, actually. To help her to keep secrets. She was a very good secret keeper when she was 21. It didn't do much damage to her character. It just bent her finger a bit. Now, keep that firmly in mind and then say, not only have you got what is called a physical body, which is energy, but this physical body is actually experienced by you through feeling. So on your ring finger, you put feeling and life force. The symbol on your little finger is Mercury. You know, Mercury is the god of commerce. And commerce is concerned with commodities, with materials. So your material body, we put it on the little finger and we mark it with the sign of Mercury. Do you know how to make the sound of Mercury? Does everybody know how to make the sound of Mercury? You do a half circle with a full circle and a cross under it. Or quickly, you do the sign of Taurus with a cross below it. Those who know will be watched by those who don't know, and those who don't know will find out by watching those who do know. That's called initiation. Now, this life force, imagine it. When this thing that was causing this lady to swell comes out, when it comes out, what does it do? Nothing? Does it go onto the ground? Does she gaze on it like that? All that time for that? What does it do? Gerhard? Volunteer, please. Primal scream. That's what I mean. We can all do it. Did I ask you to do a primal scream before, Gerhard? Not that he can recall. Because he doesn't want to go too many millions of years ago, when we had a similar encounter. Anyhow, he knows what a primal scream is. So this thing comes out, and again, Gerhard. What does she do with it? How does she interpret it? Does she say, that's primitive language for clean me up and feed me? Does she say that? Is she that smart? And does she go, my God, where's my husband? She doesn't know she's got a husband. He could have been eaten by crocodiles while he was out hunting. What does she do with this howling thing? What else does she do, Jess? Put a foot on it? She might. She might think, my God, what's that? Okay. You pick it up. And say, good gracious, I produced a thing that can make noises like I can make. If this isn't proof that I'm its mother, whatever it is. Because I too have made such noises. That's why he's gone hunting. He's out of range. So, she now knows that this creature has something that she's got. She can actually feel by identification, by the noise and the sound of tearing parts in the vocal development. Did you hear the shredding sound in that melodious... Where's Sheila for me? Melodious note from our friend Sheila Hunter. Sheila?
I'm here.
It's funny, isn't it? Every time I look at you, I can't see you.
Am I very
much fun? Yes, dear. Will you give me a nice melodious cry of a very gently born baby? Easy birth, caroling, the anti-stroke to Gerhard. New baby, melodious, on the vowel, ooh. Best quality production?
You're putting...
Prima donna?
No, you're putting a horrible dome on it. How do it the way that I feel it's got to come through?
I hope it's nice. Such a baby. That's what I call, what's his name? Reed Dick, is it? Something? Easy delivery technique. Right? Now, supposing it had been twins. Gerhard and Sheila together. Are you ready? Calm down. No, she's the baby. Special type of baby. Okay, now you're both born simultaneously, not one after the other. Countdown. 3, 2, 1, 0. Now, what does the mother do with this? What does she do with it? In some ways, this one reminds her of Daddy chasing the pig to cut its throat. And the other one reminds her of what? Herself in her best wheedle day. In the days of her wheedling, when she used to sit on a rock combing what she had of hair. And there was a lot of it in those days, you know. You didn't just comb this, you know, you comb this and this and this. How would you like to comb a hairy wife, Gerhard?
Lovely.
Now, she's going to show differential responses, isn't she? Yeah? Is she going to cast out the roaring shrieker, or is she going to say to herself, My God, a potential cutter of pig's throats, provided of food. And the other one, potential rival, Wheedler. She's going to make some kind of differentiation, isn't she? Now, this differentiation is this letter R again. And the result is that she's going to T, to tie them up in different ways, isn't she? For every R, there is a T. For every difference you can detect, there is a T. You see the difference of body, and then you see a difference of life function manifested in some kind of behavior, movement, sounds. So there is your, on your ring finger, life. And on that finger you put the symbol of the sun. The sun symbol is a dot in a circle. A dot in the circle for the sun, because the dot represents the sun itself, and the circle is the orbit of any planet around it. And all the planets get the energy for their life from the sun, which is a step-down transformer from the solar field. Now, life. There's a ritual about life. There's a difference. Now, why don't you tell me what is the difference between your physical body, inert, sitting there, and the fact that that sitting there body is breathing, and that you can feel it. Feel your body, feel the movement of your breathing, and feel what is the difference between your feeling movingness in that body and what you might call the clumpishkeit of your body, the solidity, the tendency to settle down and spread a bit. Can you feel it? Feel the mass inertia of your body, that's the grossness of your body, but feel the internal movement of the body, the vibrant quality, the vitality of the body. Feel that in the body. Can you feel your own warmth? There are two kinds of warmth. Rub your hands like this and feel if you're not going warmer. Now that's called lower heat, temporal heat, the heat of friction. We're going to talk about another heat later on. But in your physical body you can feel heat. And as your blood is going round, it's obviously rubbing, isn't it, on the walls of the arteries, and veins, and in the organs. And whenever there is a resistance to be overcome, the blood going through it frictively is warming that part, isn't it? Now, in that life force, which you get from the sun, there's a totally different kind of rightness. There's a rightness that we call the aesthetic rightness, the rightness of feeling like and dislike. On your little finger, where your body is, you know you have a body by a sensation, independently of liking or disliking. But that sensation, which may not be coloured by like or dislike, get hold of one of your fingers and feel it, and you won't like or dislike it, unless you start pinching it too hard or stroking it. So we have to distinguish between the sensation that gives you evidence that you have a body and the like or dislike of certain processes within the body. Now, if we have a right way, like bending your finger this way and not that way, for the physical body, there must be correspondingly a right way to feel and to have an attitude towards pleasure and pain. Doesn't there? So there is a pleasure-pain right. If you allow yourself to be led by pleasures and to be pushed away by pains, then you are under the dominion of that law of pleasure-pain. And in general, throughout life, it is a good thing to obey it. If you sit too near the fire and you smell burning and you don't feel anything, it could be you. If you do feel something getting hot and uncomfortable, you look down and observe that you are actually charring a bit, ordinarily you would move back a little bit. I used to have to be moved back by my mother, actually, because I was too engrossed in what I was doing to notice such things. And it was rather heavy on booties, blue of course, and other things, so I had to be carried away. Now, the ritual of life, pleasure and pain, fix that thoroughly in your mind, there is a right, a correct way of having pleasure. Pleasure means life circulation. Pleasure is very, very good for circulation of the blood. It's very good for relaxation of the organs. Pain tightens you up. Pleasure loosens you. Pain tenses you and makes you more individuated. Pleasure loosens you and de-individuates you. So that in the life ritual, if you become aware of this fact that when you are pleased, your temperature tends to go up, your circulation increases, your relaxation increases, and your general well-being is increased. That is the ritual for life. Learn to take your pleasures and pains correctly. Generally speaking, pains mean watch it, it's damaging. Pleasures mean it's good for you. But there is a little process called par association. You know what association is? Prefix it with P-A-R, it would be para, but why bother with the A when you've got one on the word association? Para association, means to associate a thing beyond itself. It's actually possible. I remember a very naughty trick that boys used to do. Shall I confess I once did it myself? For the sake of the exercise, I will confess. The naughty trick of boys was to heat some metal coinage, money, you see, and drop it on the floor. And some other boy would come along and go, you see, now he was power associated. You see, he thought all money is cold. And as the Italians say, it doesn't stink either. It's nobody's. Who can smell the owner of a new penny? Nobody. A dog could. But not a human being. They're too busy spending it. Imagine the situation. Power association means when you falsely associate something with something else. And thus make a mistake. Mistake means taking a miss, taking erroneously. You've seen the little boy with the fairy floss for the first time. He sees this great big mass of sweetie sweetie, and he says to Mummy, "Want fairy floss?" And she gives him a great big piece of fairy floss, and he opens his silly mouth and puts it in, and it vanishes. Time for another primal scream, yeah. See what I mean? You see? Again, that charming child. The fairy floss vanishes in the mouth, isn't it? You can get silent reactions too, you know. That's power association. So this great big thing, nearly as big as money, so you thought, oh, well, I'll get the same fun out of it. I'll do out of money. I'll climb over it. I'll eat it. When it vanishes in the mouth. Isn't that terrible? Par association. Very interesting word. Keep it. Every time you falsely associate one thing with another as par association. And you can associate pleasure with something because you had pleasure the last time. You remember, don't you, Trevor? First girl you ever had? Do you remember your first girl, Trevor? Not really, you see what I mean? You remember your second girl? Oh, didn't you number them? You blue beard, you. Do you remember any of them? Or are you struck with guilt? Is the wife in the audience? Is the wife in the audience, sir? No. Not sure. We won't give you away now. Do you remember any of them? Don't tell me her name, but was she nice? Yeah. Was she always nice? I'll give in. She wasn't. Right? So the first time, you thought she was nice, and later on she wasn't nice, you were a bit disappointed, right? You were power associating her, weren't you? Must have been. In retrospect. Yeah, right. Power association of feeling. You like it, and you go back again next Friday. She's out with the Pakistani. I could have sworn that she loved Bond. Power association. Don't forget it. Ring finger. Power association of like dislike. The philosophers might call it the aesthetic level of awareness. Aesthetic means, quite simply, I feel liking and disliking. Now, there's a right way of taking your feelings. Make quite sure the situation is identical to the last time in all respects if you want to get the same pleasure. Because if the situation changes, it might have changed in an essential of pleasure production. So examine it carefully to make quite sure it is actually the same girl and not her sister in her dress. Trained by another thousand, quite out of harmony with your technique. Now, there's another one. Above the level of the life force, running through the life force, there is a rippling process where these ripples intersect, and they produce internally, even without external stimuli, they produce auto-stimulation. Ideas appear in the biofield, ring finger, life force, pleasure, pain, call it biofield, life field. And at the middle finger level, put Saturn. Saturn is the planet governing time. Saturn, Chronos, Lord of Time. Use that middle finger to remind you. Now, the essence of that is that ideas follow one another in series. Serial presentation of ideas. Now, again, there is a ritual. Like in the case of the biofield, your ritual was sort your pleasures and pains out and associate them correctly, not power associatively, with the experiences you had. In the serial life, the mentational life, on your middle finger, you have ideas following each other, one after the other. And in this serial presentation, there's a law of association. And the law of association is fundamentally by similarity. Similarity of form, of time, of space, of sequence, and of emotional tone. Form, time, space, sequence, emotional tone. Following one another, the ideas. Every little idea you have, because it's a ripple in the life field, has an affective charge or emotional tone. Psychological term, affect. Affective charge, emotional tone. This emotional tone is there. It's not been added to the idea like an after gift of the divinity. It is the fact that the life field itself feels like and dislike. It is sentient power. And as it's rippling and intersecting with itself, it produces forms that we call ideas. And they follow each other in this associative manner. Form, time, place, sequence, emotional tone. And there is a correct way of looking at them. The right way. You watch the series of ideas, and you look at the idea, and you make a mental note, as you look at it, of the affect or emotional charge on that idea. And you see how ideas are associated together by similarity form or concurrence in the same time or in the same place or following in sequence like railway carriages one behind the other or mysterious emotional charge. Emotional charge can cut right across all the formal similarities or dissimilarities. It can jump times, places, break sequences, it can leap millions of years, that emotional tone, because fundamentally it is the life force itself. So the rule about the middle finger one, the time, serial, mentational process, is that you watch the affective charge and distinguish between the affective charge, the amount of like and dislike, on the idea, as to its form, as to the time in which it occurred, as to the place in which it occurred, and as to the sequential order in which these ideas followed each other. If you do this, you have the correct ritual for mentational processes. Now, on your first finger, you write comprehension. Pattern, gestalt. Gestalt, the pattern, the whole figure, not analyzed, complete in its wholeness. And what is the ritual for this? The ritual for this is stillness of mind. This is very important. It's the exact opposite of the serializing mentational process. The serializing process is going on moment by moment, new idea, chain of ideas in the mind. The comprehensional does not do that. It stands still. Now this is the difference in yoga between meditation, middle finger, serial thinking about something, and contemplation, simultaneous pattern awareness. Sitting still, sitting in Zazen, sitting still and holding whole reality in your mind. The ritual for this is sit still, don't mentate, that is, do not serialize. Hold your whole being. Let's try a little experiment with some volunteer. How about our friend Michael Graham Jr.? Michael, will you just give me a sentence making some kind of sense? Anything at all. The words come out one after the other. Yes? Anything? What subject are you thinking about possibly studying? I'm not sure. Well, that would do. I am not sure. Yeah? I'm not sure. Now, will you tell me whether you had a feeling before you serialized those words of unsurety? Mm-hmm. When you said, I am not sure, did your feeling of uncertainty hang on to the sentence, I am not sure? Or were you somehow sure that that was the right sentence to say, to express your unsurety? Mm-hmm. So observe, he had hidden in him a feeling, comprehensive feeling. When I asked him to serialize it, he had to feel about, sort out in his mind, and came out finally with, I'm not sure. He serialized what was, in fact, whole. Now, this is very important. When you have meditated, that is, serialized totally about something, you will discover that there was a pattern behind the serialization that held this serial process of thinking and ideation together, kept on the subject. Keep your mind on the subject. Hang on to it. Stick to it. That ability to stick to it implies a wholeness in the consciousness. And this wholeness is your comprehension. So the ritual for comprehension is sit still, feel and look, listen, smell, taste, touch. Use your five senses, but don't serialize them. Feel your body, feel the pressure of the bottom end of it on the ground or on the seat. Feel your musculature, feel whatever you've got, feel your temperature. Listen, sounds outside, rustling, slight movement. Breathing inside. Feel the movements going on inside. They're all going on simultaneously in a pattern. Don't say what the pattern is, that would put you back on the middle finger. Just hold it. That is the ritual for comprehension. Now there's another ritual on your thumb. Observe that those four rituals, like this, horizontal rituals, are all passives. Your physical body can be acted upon by a stimulus from outside. Your pleasure pain can be determined by stimuli from outside. Your mentational theory of thinking is determinable from outside. Your governing concept, your comprehensional pattern, can be imposed upon you from outside. But your will is at right angles to those four. Your thumb is your will. Put on your first finger Jupiter. Comprehension. Jupiter means God the Father. That's comprehension. And we will find that that first finger will show that God the Father, comprehension, is in God the Son, because this is the index finger. This comprehension one is the one that allows you to decide at what you will point before you actually serialize. So, the power that posits this index finger as a form must have come from the will. Now, nothing can impose on the will from outside. That's very interesting. People can beat your body, they can give you pleasant and unpleasant stimuli, they can talk to you incessantly night and day, and they can say, you must become a Marxist, or you must become a Hegelian, or whatever. They can say that, but they cannot affect your will. Your will is at right angles. Your will comes immediately from, as your thumb, springing out of the palm here. The thumb springs up from the palm, and the base joint of the thumb is in the palm. The middle joint is out of it, the top joint is out of it, but the base of it is in the palm. Now, if we observe that in the fingers, you've got three joints in each, and all three joints are not in the palm. They sprung out of it. And the lower level corresponds with the coronation, the drive. The middle level corresponds with your feeling, and the top level with your thinking. So that you have a drive of the body, feeling of body, thought of body. You have drive of feeling, feeling of feeling, thinking of feeling. And you have drive of serial thinking, feeling of serial thinking, and thinking of serial thinking. And you have drive to comprehend, feeling of comprehension, thought of comprehension. All visible and discussable. But in the case of the will, you can think about the will, top joint. You can feel about the will. But the will of the will, the drive, the secret, is not expressible. You cannot express the will of the will. You can express the will of the body, of the life, of serial mentation, of comprehension. You can talk about it. You can express it. You can say nothing whatever about the will of the will. The will of the will is the supreme secret, and it is hidden, like that base of the thumb, in the hexonic field, which Christ would call your angelic level, when he says about the children, their angels always face God. That is to say, your top level of your consciousness, the hexonic level, the pure eidetic, that itself has generated this individual will, but it has never revealed the will of the will. You can feel what it's like. It's very nice to be a free will. You can describe that free will means unconditioned will, unconstrained will. But what will of the will means, you cannot speak. It is ineffable. It is not voiceable, not definable. The will of the will is a mystery. Mystery is a word meaning don't bother to speak about it. Keep your mouth shut about it. Because whatever you say is ab out it, away from and out of it. You cannot describe or define the will of the will. So the ritual of the will is this. Be clear in your thought of the will. Be sensitive to the feeling of what it means to will freely. But in the will of the will, do not speak. Christ said that very simply. Do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. The right hand symbolizes power, the will. The left hand symbolizes thought, thinking about it. Don't let thinking know what the will is doing. Because if you do, you will condition the will before you start. The essence of pure willing is that you do not verbalize it. You penetrate down to the depths of being where initiative actually lives. It is a mysterious ineffable, unvoiceable, indescribable. It is the power that initiates. You can feel it. Hold your hand in balance and then do something. Feel that you have the power to do that. Feel it. You can feel it, can't you? What does it feel like to be able to go like that? Trevor? What does it feel like?
Free.
And when you think about freedom, what does freedom mean? Absence of formal constraints. Yeah? But the actual will of the will. What happens when I go like that?
A limbo.
A limbo. You see? And undefinable. The will of the will is a secret. You cannot explain the will of the will to anybody. Not even to your best friend. Try, you cannot. You can describe the feeling of it, the thought of it, but you cannot describe the will of the will. So the correct, the right, the ritual for the will is this. Give the idea to yourself, perhaps even the idea to somebody who asks for it. Describe the feeling, lovely, free. But the will of the will, don't waste your time with that one. The will of the will rests in itself. And its symbol of the thumb is Venus. Now don't be fooled by that Venus sign. Put the sign of Venus, circle with cross below it, on the thumb. And remember that Venus was not a woman in the ancient world. Venus was a mature man. Big man, plenty of muscle, plenty of whisker. Venus meant penis. Venus meant power, intelligence. Fei nous. The nous is nous, intelligence. Fei meant analytical power. Think, P-H-E, positive power in field. Fei, N-U-S, nous, intelligence. Fei nous. It has become, through a process of historical devolution, Venus, and was turned into a woman at the time the patriarchs took over from the matriarchs. But don't be fooled by the sign of the planet Venus. Venus does not mean female. It means the intelligence that knows how to posit power in the field, and that can analyze, penetrate into, find the joints, dissemble, loosen a thing that is tied up. That is the will. And then there is the right of the overseer, the palm, the episcopos, the bishop. Your palm has given birth to these five, and this ritual is the one described in the Bhagavad Gita. Worship is continual remembrance. The right of the episcopos, the overseer, the bishop, is the right whereby one remains continuously aware that these five are functions of your being. You are your own bishop when you overlook, and remember, you have a body, you have life force, feeling like, dislike, you can serially meditate, you comprehend, you have an initiative power. When you remember these simultaneously, you're your own bishop. And if you don't, you are not. That is the right of the overseer. There is another right. The whole hand there is in space. And it is that space that precipitated the universe. The right of space is called the right of voidity, the right to be nothing. The right, when somebody is trying to read your mind telepathically, to scrub it out so that you're not there mentally. Extended intensely in the appropriate way, you become mentally invisible. You may even become physically invisible so that people can't see you. Because you have blanked out. You have the right of voidity. Women know quite a lot about this, don't they? You know how to void yourself, Sheila? If Herbie is trying to get at something.
I think I can analyze it, but I know what I have to do.
Yes. You know what you have to do, and you can't analyze it. See, so where were you seated? Weren't you seated in your will of the will?
Yes.
Yeah? You can't explain to Herbie, can you? Try, just for fun. Explain to Herbie the will of the will. that wonderful thing whereby when you're trying to get at something, and you know perfectly well what it is, but you're not going to get at it, is he? Why not?
Beyond this level.
That level?
One, two, three.
Three. You can't comprehend it all. Mm-hmm. So you
can't
give it away, can you?
No, I'm not being critical.
No. Not being critical, Helen. Yes.
I think
it's okay, Helen.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can make that loop
yes.
That's not a conceit statement, it's a sort of
it's an if statement, isn't it? It's a sort of gift from somewhere or other, essential in your being that you can do it, isn't it? I mean, you didn't work hard to do it, did you?
No.
No, you've always been able to do it, haven't you? Far back as you can.
That you've been talking about it.
That makes you reflexive. And it's the aim of all ritual to drive you ultimately to reflexivity, so that you actually know what you know instead of just knowing it without knowing it. Yeah? So we have this mysterious group of powers. We could add them up. If we count the spaces in between the fingers, we will finally finish up with the number 13. And we're going to examine these again in a slightly different way. In primitive societies, if we go back far enough, we will find that the relation we call symbiotic, when beings are living together in such closely intimate contact in their living field, they cannot separate themselves out. Babies are not separable from their mother. Now the type of this is the baby in utero. The baby is not separate from the mother. Call that the symbiotic relationship. That is a life interpenetrating another life field. We put the life field on the ring finger, didn't we? And this life field and this life field are interpenetrating. These two lines are not separable. I want you to imagine that a long time ago, all that we now call the human race had its ancestors, and that they were not in any way separable from each other. It's a state called panic living. Now, pan means all, is a Greek word, meaning nature as a whole unanalyzed. And in that state, if a man was bitten by a tiger, then the whole community felt the bite. We call that a protopathic, non-analytic, non-separable condition. Now how would you like it so that if I went and kicked Greta on the shin, everybody's shin ate? Would you like it? Or would you rather Greta have it? David Hume once said, he was a great skeptic, he said, why should I bother about the death of 100 people if the alternative is my finger being pricked? My finger, and the pin in it, hurting. If I'm totally self-centered, the death of 100 other people means nothing compared with a pinprick. So if I have to choose, I will have to say, shoot that 100 people. I don't like pinpricks. That would be thoroughgoing, true, separative egotism.
Well, wouldn't they feel the birth of that baby?
Yes. In those days, in the protopathic panic state, everybody felt everything that happened in that group, the family, the tribe. Nobody was separable. And the whole thing rotated round the right of the mother. The mother had delivered the babies. The babies had delivered the babies. And they delivered the babies. In three generations you had a tribe. And the mother who had started the process was supreme goddess. If you look at her in the Willendorf virgin shape, you will see she has no feet, no hands. She's got lovely thighs, a great tum, marvellous bosom, no face, tight curls. She's the Willendorf virgin. She sits on the throne. She has no feet because she doesn't need to move. The children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren are doing all the work. She has no hands. She doesn't need to feed herself. Because the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, they come, they put food in her mouth. She is the author, the origin, the source of their being. And whatever she feels like, everybody feels like. If she frowns, everybody frowns. Think what that's like. Great-grandmother has frowned. We have all to go about the house like this. You know what it's like, don't you? Remember that rule, biogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That means that the process of individual development of a single life copies exactly the phylum, the large category of the race from which you derive. So, you've seen kiddies. Great-grandmother is having a nap. It passes down the line, doesn't it? Have you ever crept about on tiptoes? So as not to disturb some worshipful ancestors? Yeah. We're bound to repeat some of our ancestral experience, either reflexively or non-reflexively. Now imagine in that state, the protopathic, the panic state, we were all symbiotic. We lived and we had a field that had not yet been separated. It is incorrect to call it a common field, because common means counting together, and they did not count. They hadn't learned to count yet. They were not separate. Community is a much later idea. I want you to think the type of it is in utero, where the baby is not separated from the mother. Now when the baby comes out into the world, the ritual has changed. Because the ritual in utero is that mother does the eating and child gets the feeding. If she likes to go on gin and tonic or methylated spirits, baby drinks methylated spirits. Mother is the boss. There is no argument. So the ritual for that super panic state is all comes down from the great grandmama, the Maha Ma, as they used to say. Even greater than the Maha Maha Ma. That was sort of ultimate of all Maha Ma's. That was when the one that was visible on earth claimed absolute descent from the infinite power of the original Maha Maha Ma. Your ordinary man is a Ma. Her ma's a maha, ma. And her ma's a maha, maha, ma. Am I talking Japanese at the moment? I'm getting that time I commit harakiri, I think. Now, when the baby comes into the world, there's a new ritual. He falls out. She's not used to the process yet, so he falls on his head. Oh, new emergent. Bang on the napper. New emergent, signal. Never had one of those before. Gerhardt? We didn't rehearse this, by the way. Right. New emergent. The individual out from this symbiotic relationship. Does this little child enjoy everything the mother makes it do? No. Some of the things, like washing behind the ears, he doesn't like. So, within the meaning of individuality, there is not only the recapitulation of the symbiotic relationship, there is not only the recapitulation of absolute union with the mother, with the grandmother, with the great-grandmother, with the sisters and brothers and cousins and so on. There is potential individuation there. And we said put Mercury on that thing, didn't we? Mercury is the god of commerce and the god of quickness and the god of individuated behavior. He's the god of thieves, rogues, businessmen, anything that's got any intelligence of an individual order. He is the god of it. That means to say that when you're an individual and you fall out on your own head, it sharpens you in a way that it doesn't sharpen you quite when Mother falls downstairs when you are still inside. Falling on one's own head is different from falling on Mother's head. So here we have in the individual a new right. If there's going to be falling, make sure it's not you. This is the beginning of egoic consciousness. Now, what ordinarily tends to happen when baby falls on its head, it screams, mother instinctively rushes and picks it up, and the child then regresses back into this original, whole, pre-individuated level. It is now one with the original source of life, and gets comforted. Now, if we are not careful, something will go wrong at this point. Every time the baby falls, it will run to mummy. It will power associate, because it will run to mummy, even if it gets a little hurt. Have you ever put your finger in your mouth to get rid of a piece of chewing gum and accidentally bitten your own finger? Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen it to mummy to be kissed better? Have you? No? You remember that? Bit finger? Ah, magic. Restored. Now, if you do this too often, your ritual has gone wrong, you all. Hasn't it? This is very important. Remember, everything has a positive and a negative. The positive of egoic awareness is individual freedom. The negative of it is isolation. Alienation from the group. And what happens then? If you are an individual and on going to mummy with your newly bit little finger, she looks at it quickly because she's busy knitting and says, no blood, go away and play. Alienation, rejection, the source of life has cut me off. And what does the child do then when it's alienated and pushed away in this manner? Try and find another source. What it tends to do is break with the community. That's very important. To break with the community. Now there's a ritual for breaking. But what happens if it really breaks with the community? Imagine a community, let's say, of hunters. And the hunters, the males, go out and they chase some animal that's quite fierce, a wild boar perhaps, or a bison or something. If they have a sufficient number of men, they can kill it, can't they? If they have an insufficient number of men, what's going to happen? They could be killed, maimed, or starved, couldn't they? So if anybody wants to run away from this group, are they not weakening the group? So what is the group reaction to any individual attempt to grow in individuation?
Bring him back.
The inertia of that ritual is still with us. Very strongly. We cannot afford to lose an individual member of society and weaken our society. So therefore, what does the group leader, the Mahamahama, say about kiddies who run away? From the dizzy height of her mountain of cushions. Bring it back. Yeah. What else does she do? If she's a smarty.
Give it something that will not make it run away again.
Stick and carrot game. Yeah? But supposing it doesn't want this thing, because when it was away, it found an apple. It doesn't want it. You might kill it, and in fact it was done. But there was another method, a threat. What would you threaten it with? Supposing you can't think about anything except your recorded experiences, the content of your own being. What would you think of doing with the baby that came out of you?
Send it back.
Send it back. Now there was a ritual called sending back. You know what they did? Say, do you know where you came from? You like go back? What does baby say?
No.
No? If you get a baby that wants to be treated like a baby younger than it is, I want to be treated like I was treated when I was a baby. Say, okay, how old are you? 5. Okay. So you grab hold of the baby, you strip its clothes off it, you put a nappy on it, safety pins, you put it back in the cot and you tie it down. Right? Now, in its pure form, it was done like this. You can imagine this lady with no feet, no hands, no face, curls, with a thumb like this. Naughty boy, you won't go back where you came from. How does little boy feel?
Terrified.
He's probably already been half smothered by affection. So he's a little chary about that. But to make quite sure the ritual was good and real, and knowing it was a bit difficult actually to fulfill it, what did they do? Instead of doing the actual fact, what did they do? They dug a hole in the ground. They made a womb in the earth. They called the earth Mother Earth. And they dug a hole in it and said to the little boy, you are going back where you came from. And they put him in the ground. And they put the earth on him. How was he feeling? This was called the earth rite. You bury the little so-and-so. Now, if you were a bit short of hands in the tribe, you gave him a snorkel. And you didn't leave him under too long. Just long enough to scare the pants off him. Now, he had one of two reactions to this, didn't he? Either he towed the line evermore, and say he was a sissy, or he thrashed about a bit, and at the first opportunity, he either killed Mahamahama, or he got out. Now, if he got out, he was then what is called hero. Observe that mysterious word, hero. It means the power has now been differentiated. He who has recognized this hierarchy is now going to break it. What is his psychological state, and what is the right for him? The right is the correct thing for him to do. He's going to create a difference. He leaves this tribe, and he starts coming occasionally and knocking off a member of the tribe. He might try to persuade one or two brothers to go with him, or he might just crack a few skulls when they go to the well to get water. These are reprisals against the ones that cause him to be driven out. Right? So there is a right for the hero. Now I want you to put this process here on the light finger, the light dislike, and see that if you get a sufficient number of painful experiences, it will individuate you progressively more and more. Your Maha Maha Ma could keep you, if she was kind to you and fed you, in permanent subjection, couldn't she? Yes? Do you know anybody who's been kept like that? In perfect subjection? I know one or two. The mother knows exactly what they need and she gives it to them. Nobody else does. True. Can you believe that somebody would say to his wife, I want the rock cakes made like mummy makes them. Yeah? Now that's a sign, isn't it? That the ritual was there. That mother knew a thing or two. She wanted to keep him in the tribe. She gave him the carrots. Well cooked. But if that boy goes out sufficiently hurt, he is going to go in time, is he not? In time, after a lapse of time, he, by his pains, is going to become progressively more and more individuated. For every pain he receives, because he's non-reflexive, he's going to inflict a similar pain on some member of his commune, if he can. So if he gets very badly treated by the tribe and he's thrown out, he will wait and if he sees a tired member going for water and there's nobody about, he will hit him with a stone axe and polish him off. And he will try to convert as many of the young men as possible. Now, after a time, you will find it's very peculiar, because in this life heroic, he has to go about, he has to hit everything hard, he has to try to get other heroes to join him, but if they're as good as he is, or better, he is in danger of becoming subordinate to them, is he not? In other words, there's a serious danger if a hero knows another hero, that one of them will assume this relation instead of that. You know that, which way up is it? The perfect partnership, 50-50, doesn't exist. So that when a hero goes out, he'd better stay on his own and look for people slightly less powerful than he is to remain on top. Because if they're not weaker than he is, then he will go under, and he might as well have stayed where he was. So he finds a peculiar thing happening. He is progressively more and more isolated by his own heroism, his own getting out, his own differentiation of power. When he goes out in this way, he finds that his alienation from the group has imposed tremendous things on him. What happens to him in his isolation, in his alienation from those? He tries to make a group of other heroes, but he has to watch these heroes. You read your Greek mythology. Don't these heroes fall out with each other? Don't they lose their tempers? Don't they get so mad that one kills another? Aren't they always doing penances for one murderous act or another? And so, the heroic tends to move towards, through his alienation, a feeling of misery. He tends to go into Saturn. The symbol of Saturn, time, the repetition of the process and the alienation in time and space, make him melancholy. So that the classic symbolism of Saturn means dark, black, melancholia. He becomes ascetic. He becomes aware that this heroism doesn't necessarily pay off. And when he gets a bit older, as heroes do, does not his physical power begin to diminish? What does he do then? Does he still feel like fighting? Or has he, through time, accumulated wisdom? Right, so Saturn, which means melancholy, which means the darkness, which means time process, also means wisdom. So you see the figure of Saturn, Kronos, the temporal process, symbolizing wisdom. But the wisdom of accumulated serial experiences. He doesn't want to fight anymore. If he meets a hero, he'll give him good advice. And if possible, he'll try to get the good advice in before the hero removes his head. So, there is a right there. The right of wisdom. You can see it in dogs, when you see a grey-haired dog with grey hairs around its mouth, walking along with a bit of rheumatism. Doesn't the rheumatism give dignity to that dog? And when you see the shambling gait of a puppy, it takes a bite of this old one. Doesn't this terrible rage of the once hero, which has been progressively condensed inside him because of his growing awareness that he's getting older and weaker, doesn't his rage and his self-examination and his desire to become powerful like he once was, which he knows he isn't and cannot be, does not all this become a terrible growling inside him? Doesn't he rely on growls to keep the young ones in order? Is this the meaning of the elder statesman? The ability to sound as if you can tear them to pieces, in spite of your rheumatism. So there's a right there, a correct thing to do. At that level, you have to be wise and learn to growl, lower the voice. get rid of the Donald Pears from The Voice or the Tiny Tim. Then we come on to the right of the Comprehender. Tell me what it is, dear.
It's experience that sounds through it, and it's the knowing that it will be your brain.
The knowing it will be your brain. Would that be an accumulation of experiences of actual obedience of other beings to the word?
Yes.
Yes, a growing confidence. So a person who is very wise, who has been a sufficiently violent hero, and seen enough deaths, and heard enough shouts, and had his eyes open, would see to which shouts, to which tones people had responded, then he could actually come to believe in the tone of authority, couldn't he? And then you would tend to believe him. It would be a growth of his experience. So there's a right there. And here is another right, the right of the comprehender. The man who does not operate apparently from experience, but from knowledge of the whole plan. Imagine the man who says, I know the plan of the universe. In India, he would be a Brahmin. A man who understands the broad Brahman needs to extend, to stretch out the broad issues of being, the broad issues of universal existence. The right there to have an air of having seen everything, so you don't need to go anywhere. Tell me something that's happening in the Amazon. I know about it. Tell me something that's happening on the river Po. In Italy. I know about it. Tell me, don't waste your time telling me anything. I've been. It isn't worth it. I comprehend. Imagine an infinite sphere, and the right of that sphere is to assume a sort of spherical type expression. Comprehending all things. So that even the growly voice of the one-time hero who has become a sage ascetic, even he cannot frighten the comprehender. The comprehender says, all things are cyclic. What he said to the great hero was, you will die. And you will go into a place called Hades, the land of the Shades. And in that land, all your heroism is nothing. Your weapons are nothing. You are merely shadows. So you've been a great hero all your life and you've bashed everybody. And then you had to go into a place called Shade Land. And there you were just a shade. And the lowest man in the village was a shade. He wasn't more shady than you. He was just like you, the same. Two-dimensional. Pale. Are they happy? No. Are they miserable? No. They're nothing, these shades. Can you imagine what it's like to be a shade in Hades? Agamemnon, Achilles, Ajax. Great a man with greater muscle. I look, see. Horrible. I can see straight through my muscle. It's a shade. How do you feel? The comprehender says, all things are doomed, and they must go down. They must go into the land of Pluto. The land once ruled by Hermes. And they must there become subject, no longer great heroes. And the Lord of the cycle knows this. He knows the whole cycle. And he knows that being a shade in this way is a bit colourless. And all the great egotism of the great heroes is rendered null and void in this underworld, in the shades. And while he's busy intimidating everybody, this fellow bobs up. And he says, very nice. How about initiative? How about the resurrection? You've just told me about four ways of dying. Earth way of dying, water way of dying, fire way of dying, air way of dying. How about this? The will. I don't care about your repetition of cycles. In the ancient world, they had agricultural cycles. They knew the calendar inside out and backwards. They could predict solar eclipses. They could predict the flooding of the Nile. They could predict everything in the agricultural cycle, and they had intimidated everybody. One man said, no, this cycle was posited and is reposited by an act of will. And the man of will said, I ignore your cycle. I imagine the man of will, who ignored the cycle, was absolutely opposed to the four other modes. He was liberated from their inertias, from the repetitions, and he was free. What is the right for him? The right for him is a simple right, immediacy. There is no past, there is no future, there is here now the will to precipitate or not, at will, from the will of the will, mysteriously, with no explanation, just posit something. What can those four do with him? Nothing. If they knew he existed, what would they do with him? Try to kill him. Now, that one, that thumb, the anthropologist would say, is a phallic symbol and is related to the Messiah, the resurrector, he who must rise again, the will, the eternal will. It comes up. No matter how often you knock it down, it comes up. And the person who is like that, centered in the will, he says, if you kill my body, if you give me pains, if you give me serial arguments, if you give me repetitive processes based on an eternal cycle within a spherical domain, I ignore them. If you kill me, I resurrect. The next moment I'm up again. You can kill my body, you cannot kill my will, because my will has never been in existence as a form. My will is a power which is eternal, and you cannot get at it. The will of my will you cannot touch. Therefore you can murder my body, you can hurt it, you can insult the thought processes, you can offer me erroneous ones in exchange, you can give me a new plan. I might say, no, cui bono, to whom the good, what is the meaning of your plan? I am a being of will, I do not need a plan, I need nothing, I am immediate. That is the Messiah, the resurrector, who resurrects now, here, every moment. Now, to reach that level of awareness isn't very far away. An ordinary man goes up to middle finger. That is, he's got a body, pleasure pains, serial thinkings. He has not normally got a very clear governing concept. Karl Marx had a clear governing concept that the processes of human evolution in society had something to do with commodity necessity development. That was one. Hegel had another one, a little earlier than Marx, that the universe was logical, that the rational is the real, the real is the rational, and cosmos is understandable in logical processes. Those are good ideas. They were good ideas, but idea is only form. The will generated the form. So that St. Augustine with his doctrine of the will, Kierkegaard with his subjectivity is truth, Nietzsche with his doctrine of the will, they're beyond Hegel, they're beyond Marx, they're beyond any commune, any formal pattern. They're in the will. The right of the will to be immediate, to initiate, to give no explanations. Explanations are lower than the will. If somebody would like an explanation, they could have a handful. They're all irrelevant. The right of the will to be immediate. And it's only two steps up from the ordinary man. All the ordinary man has to do is get a governing concept. But the governing concept is not to be that there is a form that can save you. Forms build systems. The word system, system, means saviour for a time. But it does not save you eternally. Nothing saves you eternally except the will. So you're only two steps up. Get a governing concept, and let the governing concept be, I rest in my will, not in an idea. Julius Caesar had it. The cause is in my will. St. Augustine had it. Nietzsche had it. Blake had it. Babies have it, but not reflexively. Now the thing is to get it reflexively. Get your concept. But let your concept not be of an idea or a system that can make you secure. Because there is no security in time by a system, but temporarily. There is no permanence. But in the will, in the immediacy of here now, there is the only real salvation. So the right of the will is immediacy. And there, down in the will of the will, in the palm, in the hexagon, in your angel, there is your real self. The will has its mysterious non-process, the mystery, the inexplicable, whereby it comes to whatever it does without explanation. And there we see how rituals have developed. And all the particularized rituals, the details of ritual, like puberty rituals in primitive times, and rituals of towels and feathers, and rituals of painting noses red in engineering workshops, all those things are derivative from a primary concept. The concept that when you act, you create a difference. And the difference that you create, the letter R, crucifies you, the letter T, fixates you permanently. And when you know this and you rise through these four passive formal ways to the will, you then know that when you are willing, if you posit a form, you crucify yourself. But supposing you don't posit a form and lean on it, supposing that every form you posit is a fantasy, that is, you know it will dissolve. What does Kierkegaard say about that? Supposing you know that every coin you utter is a false one, that's the Indian doctrine of Maya. The will posits a form, but the form does not limit the will. The form is something that is posited there to make an appearance, a phenomenon, to capture the imagination of the capturable. But the will itself does not fall into identification. It remains will, hidden in itself. Now, in people ordinarily, non-reflexively, they're identified with their physical body as reference point, with their pleasures and pains when they're operative, with their mentation processes when they're asleep, and for part of their dream life also. They have very little comprehension and hardly any universal governing concept. But in this will of the will, there is this absolute freedom of immediacy. And there is an awareness that everything you do that is expressible, every concept you define formally, every reason you give serially, every cry of pleasure or pain, and every bruise on your body, all those things have been precipitated by the will as phenomena, as appearances. And they have no meaning, no more meaning than the shades in Hades, unless you will them to have meaning. Unless you will a form to have meaning, it has not. If another person wills a form for you, if I say to you all, vote for the common market, or say no. That's a form. It would come out of my will. If you thought there was any sense in it other than my will, you would be self-deceived, because it would be your will to believe, not mine for saying it. Now, people are very fond of believing things and then blaming somebody for leading them into it. You cannot be led into anything unless it is in conformity with your deep will. So then you recognize the true position, the true right of the will is this, that the whole universe is posited for each individual, from within the individual, from the center of the will of the will, posited in all its details, including motor cars and houses. All these are posited by the will, and by the will they can be wiped out. If you identify with the thing posited, you go under the law governing the thing. If you do not, you do not go under that law. You remain a free being. Now, in this process of observing how the will can climb up from body awareness, and by initiation, remember the baby fell on his head first, to become individuated and separated from the mother, his head struck the ground, not hers. His own likes and dislikes, his own thoughts grew out of the pain. His individuation comes out of pain. This is a great meaning of ascetic existence thousands of years ago. By self-imposed penances, by deliberate self-suffering, by deliberate restraints, impositions of things we don't like, individuation grows. This individuation climbs up and up and up until finally it realizes itself in the reflexive will, and it recognizes that it, the will, posited the whole process, and that it has been working backwards into itself only because it forgot that once it was will, that the will posited for itself the concept, the pattern, the whole pattern of its life, and then went into the whole pattern, energized it, serialized it, so that that will then appeared in time. And then it clothed itself with the sun, clothed with the sun, the life power. And it took that life power, that clothing of the sun, and sent it into a body of gross matter with it. And it posited those in that way. And then it forgot, in the words of Plato, in the myth, choosing the lives in that eternal, in the hexameic, you drink the waters of Lethe, of forgetfulness, and you enter into time to have an experience. What is it like to be symbiotic? What is it like to be in a mother, in another being, inside another being, so that your whole being is conditioned? Think what it's like. A will that was absolutely free posits itself into the total bondage of the uterus, where the mother's breathing, her diet, her quarrels, her pleasures, continuously affect through the biofield of this child internally. What is it like? You haven't got a mind of your own. You haven't got a will that is not interfered with by the will of this creature who is carrying you. You haven't got a body free from her processes. You haven't got a like or dislike that is not interfered with by hers. You are in utero. You are in what Freud thought was omnipotence, the omnipotent sense. You're all powerful. You're absolutely penetrated by your mother and her mother's 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 mother. The ancestors have got you. What is it like to be inside sphere upon sphere upon sphere upon sphere? Imagine each of the mothers, right back to the absolute, was a sphere, and each mother developed itself internally, a child which became a mother of a child, a mother of a child, a mother of a child, and right in the middle, sitting inside there, is the new baby. And it hasn't got anything. It isn't interfered with by everything. How can it be itself? So it has to say, out. We want out, common market. It has to launch itself, fall on its own head. It started the climb back. When it's gone through the whole process, back to the will, reflexively, we have proved it. When we were in the infinite, absolute, free spirit, which is God, says Christ, God is spirit, in that we didn't know what it meant to be absolutely conditioned. So we threw ourselves down. And the only way we can get into the time world in a living body is through a mother. So the spirits in the infinite are watching and looking at women, looking at men. And they keep a sharp eye on the boys and girls. And as soon as two get together, as soon as the sperm enters the egg, whoosh, down. That's for me.
And what's the difference between that uterine feeling as the precious of all else fears and being in the hexonic field later on?
In the difference is in the hexonic field you have no edges. You're absolutely penetrated, and in utero you are inside the amniotic sac, and you are aware of a pressure on your physical body that doesn't go through you like it does in the hexonic field. It hits on your body, you have a haptic sensation. Now in the hexonic field you don't have that. You have a mutual interflowing and passing through a transcendence, an absolute transcendence, the jijimunga. Reciprocal interpenetration of all beings, but no sense of haptic limit. But in utero you have that. And that is the whole process of the ritual. A ritual for every level, and the process whereby, if you remember it, you assume absolute responsibility for yourself. We move through the world, through time. The war is not over yet, the temporal war. There's another war. The external war, Muhammad called the little war. The internal war, whereby I fight my way through from all these dependencies to my reflexive free will, that you call the great war, the inner war. You climb up to this. Only one way, by continuous self-examination of body, of feeling, of thought process, of governing plan, and then reflexive awareness that you've posited the plan. And until you do this, you will erroneously think that somebody else is responsible for your misery, or your happiness, your success, or your failure. In the next few years, we will see more and more and more of what Nietzsche prophesied and what the Revelation prophesies. Wars, rumors of wars, scatterings, dropouts, failures, and a gradual awareness in certain groups of people who are working towards it, who are self-elected by grace, and grace means the freedom of their own spirit at the top level, who are self-elected to carry themselves through the whole process, so that when the next big cataclysm strikes, many will panic, they will regress, because the natural thing when you get hurt is back to mama. But those who persist in this upward movement towards reflexiveness, they're going to have a different kind of future. They're going to have a permanent future, in which future means the law is established by the power of the will itself. Millions will perish. Those of you who saw that horrible Vietnam film last night have a rough idea, in a little measure, of what will happen in the future. Millions will perish, but those who focus upon this process and who remember that they threw themselves down into the body and they're climbing back up to reflexive awareness, they are the elect, self-elect by the inner spirit of God inside them. They will not panic. They won't regress and collapse. They will discover what Christ meant when he said, when he was told, make these stones into bread. Man does not live by bread alone. We are in a field of power. That power has posited this hexon, our real self. And that hexon has manifested itself in the individual will. And in that time of the testing, you will feel yourself fed by the power. You feel it around you, feeding through you. It will give you information about where to be when. It will give you resistance to all the epidemics, to all the diseases, to all the panic fears that will attack the unprepared. And if you persist to the end being reflexive self-consciousness, you will find that the energy in your being is self-renewing, self-resurrecting. The whole stress, the whole focus of your consciousness would not be in gross matter anymore. It would be in this field of intelligent power. You won't care what happens to you. They shoot a bullet through your head, and it passes through your head, and it heals. Because it's his only power. You know, during the last war, there was a pilot who got a wound in the head. He thought it was a surface wound. And he carried on. He landed his plane. He got out. He went to the MO. The MO looked. He said, you had a bullet through the head and the man dropped dead. That was inertia. He had the theory, bullet through head equals death. Now that kind of equation is death. But the other thing is, I lay my life down, I take it up again. That's what Christ tells you. If you go to my Father, that is to say to the whole field of sentient power, greater works than these shall you do. Mendings of little odd bones and little blindnesses and so on there. You will do much greater than that. You will be able to reassemble yourself. You will be able to reposit yourself. This is the target. This is the goal. And the ritual for that is, remember self-positing. And repositing is your work. No one else's. You posit and reposit yourself momently. And each moment is new. Don't think you can posit yourself now for 5 minutes hence. You can't. You posit yourself in every split second. And what you posit in that split second, willfully, reflexively, you become in that instant. You actually synthesize the essential materials of your being as an act of will every moment. And when you do that, what have you got to worry about? Nothing. Where are we going to start?
When this baby was born to this early woman, how did she decide to separate it from her?
How did she decide? Well, she didn't. Go back to the beginning. We start with an infinite field of sentient power. Is that right? Cause means a blow struck, and blows are struck by power. So if we want to know what is the first cause, we have to go to an infinite power. Now, that infinite power, before there is any existential finite world, must be conceived to be an infinitely extended power, mustn't it? Then if there is to be a cause, that is a blow struck, upon what will it strike? It can only strike like this, can't it? It must contract itself, condense, and create a center by condensation. Condensation, condense, means with judgment issue. When it condenses, the field, which was free absolutely, becomes bound, doesn't it? Self-bound. Now, the field posits the original substance. The original substance name is Ma. You know what Ma means, don't you? The mother principle. The M-O in mother and the M-A in Ma are the same. Except the M-O means the sphere. Encapsulation. And the M-R means substantial activity. So you have a substantial sphere, M-O, and you have a substantial activity, because the sphere is only a sphere, because it is actually compressing itself. So the first mother, like the first hen, is laid by the field. The infinite field posits the mother. And having posited that zone of encapsulation, who is going to conduct the processes in it? When that field, which is viewed in this infinite sense, is considered, we are considering omnipotence, aren't we? All power. Now, all power is greater than any part power, isn't it? And if it condenses like this and makes a sphere, is that sphere not finite? And hasn't it dropped in potential? Hasn't it become less powerful by being condensed? If it is less powerful, and there is an infinite power beyond, and this infinite power beyond is intelligent power, sentient power, doesn't it follow that the one that is posited must be transparent to the one that posited it? Because the one that posited it has higher potential. So the lower one must be transparent or permeable to the infinite. So then any process conducted inside the zone of encapsulation must be conducted by the infinite. So who delivers the baby? God. The field. Yeah? No finite can do it. She can't freely will anything until she becomes reflexive. To be free is the product of work.
Could you relate dominion there then?
Dominion.
Dominion, because you have said that not even God can dominate man because they are atheists. So that the individual has a free will to reject even God.
God has posited a purpose. Yes, God has posited a purpose to make man free-willed. Mm-hmm. So that the free will that man has is by permission.
Once he gives that permission, the individual has free will.
Momently. Because God posits everything like this.
That's the only free will there is.
Like this. Mm. The only free will there is. Mm. In the moment. Yeah. So only a momentary being has got it. And only moment by moment, in the reflexive act.
But in order to fulfill all righteousness, all things are possible. So the woman could have said no, or could still.
Only by absolute permission, because he posits her in the first place with the intent that she shall become reflexive.
So at that moment that he delivers, then she is, the will, her will and God's will are coincident.
Right.
At that moment,
yes.
Of decision. No, it can't be decision,
can it? Well, decision means cutting from. There is certainly a cutting from. The thing to remember is this: is it reflexive in the individual level?
So are you saying here, and I know you are, that a person becomes reflexively self-conscious by permission?
Called grace.
Or grace.
And as you said, it doesn't matter how much work a person does, ultimately it is the absolute that opens the door.
Mm-hmm.
Can you clarify how, therefore, in order to move towards perfected self-consciousness, the person has to get hold of their own free will, and yet the will of the will is mysterious and free and can't be got hold of, and it depends upon the grace of God to do it anyway?
Well, that's in the parable of the prodigal son, isn't it? Because the prodigal son is a son who asks for his inheritance, he's given it before his father dies, and goes into the world and spends it, and goes right down till he's living with pigs, symbol of obstinacy, eating husks, symbol of externality and meaninglessness. And he turns around then because there's nowhere else to go. And he's gone where he was driven, into prodigality. So there, the will of God to give him the money to go with has actually posited him in the pigsty.
Yes, and at those lower three levels, he gets there.
Yes.
Right.
So then his turnaround is for him natural. He himself says, I have sinned against heaven and against my Father, when he's sitting with the pigs.
Then is the turnaround the comprehension? And he has now transcended the mechanicality, or has he mechanically got to the term and thinks the only place is to try to go back?
He mechanically got to the term of comprehension. And that's a question of whether, in his comprehension, he will turn back again upon himself. That's called dog returns to vomit.
So you're saying there that his return home was, in fact, a positive act, positive by himself.
Yes.
And not due to the external situation of living with the pigs.
Oh, no, it wasn't due to the pigs.
Because, well, the opposite. He's taken it out into himself.
Yes, by divine grace. God posited him in the whole process down to the pigs for the express purpose of bringing him up to the point where, comprehending, he wills to return.
So he could have stayed at that level had it not been for the grace of God coming in, he could have stayed there eternally.
Yes.
He depends on the grace of God. Though.
Oh, yes.
Nothing he can do at the individuated level.
Except wish he was out of it.
Yeah.
And be overlooked by the Absolute, who decide whether or not he's sincere in wishing to be out of it, or whether he needs an extra turn of the screw.
So, in other words, it happens.
As far as the finite ego is concerned, yes.
Is this what creates the anger, then? The fact that we know that he is dependent on the grace of God and there's nothing to do about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But remember this, that what you call anger when you're identified with your finitude is a tiny bit of the anger which is God the Father. And it means exactly the opposite.
The grace of God is within you anyway. It's the anger in you. The grace of God must be in you.
But it transcends you as well, absolutely, as a finite being. Just like your individual anger is yours, but that little zone of anger in you is just a little pocket of anger in the infinite anger of God the Father. Now, anger doesn't mean the same thing to God the Father that it means to a finite being, because finite beings don't like it, do they? And they think in their anger that if they smash some finite, they will get where they want to get. God's anger is exactly the opposite. His anger is an energy which dissolves rubbish. Whatever is not worth preserving, the anger of God consumes it, reduces it. That's right, super weed killer. Yeah. So that whereas in the case of the angry human being, he thinks if he smashes a few brothers and sisters or mothers-in-law things, that he will have happiness, he's not trying to get rid of things that are no good, is he? He's trying to get rid of finite things that are getting in the way of his no good purposes. That's the exact opposite. The anger of God is quite simply that he spends a large amount of his time breaking down rubbish that has accumulated into primary energy. You know how if you eat a sprout, you attack it in your tummy and you break it down and you reduce it to non-sprout energy, don't you? And you then deploy that energy in your being intelligently for some organic purpose. Now, in the same way, men are excreting, and have done so from the beginning of time, erroneous concepts, wrong emotions, and they pour these out into space, and they fall onto centers, and they make accumulations of nonsense and fantasy and misery, which sensitive people can pick up, and they can be made ill by them. The fire of the Absolute dissolves these, it digests them as surely as that acid in your tongue can digest your dinner. And it does so, wherever it decides to do so. But if a particular piece of rubbish is useful in a certain place to annoy somebody who needs a bit of prodigal experience, it moves it along to that person, so that person can have a rubbishy experience.
When Jesus says he can build a temple again in 3 days, what do you think saying about the free will? Jesus put himself on his own cross in absolute balance, and yet the free will of the Absolute could have been for him not to resurrect.
Could have been, yes.
So how could Jesus say beforehand that he could?
Because he said, "What the Father wills for me to do, that I do." Remember, it's only momentary. When he's on that cross, he's not thinking, tomorrow I'll be dead and buried, and the day after that I'll be resurrected. He's dealing with what is happening now. And he's ready for God to change his mind.
If he's not to change his mind, and his earlier prophecy would not have been right, he couldn't have built a temple again in 3 days, could he?
Of course he could.
But he wouldn't.
How do you know?
Because if God freely had changed his mind, Jesus wouldn't have been resurrected off the cross in 3 days.
How do you know? He could have changed his mind again.
In free will.
He could have changed his mind again.
And again.
And again. Infinitely.
It takes a lot longer than 3 days.
No, not at all, because changing one's mind in eternity doesn't take time. See, what you're doing, you're importing serial thinking into the eternal.
But I'm trying to understand free will.
The will of the will you can't understand. It is immediately experienced. You can think about it as an unconditioned initiative. You can feel it, very pleasant, free feeling. But to understand the will of the will, you cannot. Nobody, not even the Son of God, knows that.
But hasn't the will of the will still to commit it?
It doesn't have to do anything.
Well, to become existential, hasn't it, to commit itself into the Logos, to serve the Logos, the form that is in existence.
It creates it. Existence is inside the Logos.
Yeah, and then commits itself to it. And then obeys it.
According to its own will, yes. And dissolves it and reobeys it. What you're doing there is imposing a conditioning process upon the will, which is absolutely free. The whole time scale can be altered. The length of days can be altered. Day can mean anything to the infinite power. The tendency is to import temporal thinking into eternal considerations, which loses the point of the paradox that eternity, which is not time, has time, seriality, in it, and that the decisions of the infinite are not penetrable by the finite serial thinking mind. That's why to get to it you have to keep still. You have to stop the rationalizing process, still the mind, and re-experience the will of the will in consciousness. The whole time scale can be altered. The length of days can be altered. They can mean anything to the infinite power. the tendency to import temporal thinking into eternal considerations, which loses the point of the paradox that eternity, which is not time, has time, see reality, in it, and that the decisions of the infinite are not penetrable by the finite, serial thinking mind. That's why to get to it you have to keep still. You have to stop the rationalizing process, still the mind, and re-experience the will of the will in consciousness, momently.
When it leads to level of comprehension, you have to serialize what you've comprehended.
No, you don't. You've already done that.
If you verbalize it.
Well, then, if you verbalize it externally, you're serializing the expression.
But you're not serializing it
internally.
Mm-hmm.
Internally, you're still comprehending.
Yes.
With the external expression, you would have serialized.
Yes.
But that wouldn't affect the simultaneity of your comprehension.
No.
And this is the paradox. That the thing that's in time takes what you call time, the thing you serialize. Every moment of it, every turning, every orientation is simultaneous in eternity. So the problem is solved before it is posited. When we talk about God having gained the victory before the foundation of the world, that's what we mean. Before time is fabricated, the problem is already resolved in eternity. The use of time is serialization so that finite beings, individuated human beings, can, through the analytic process of temporal serialization, learn bit by bit what is too much for them to comprehend simultaneously, eternally. They're thrown down into the world to experience serial, moment by moment, ideational structures, one after the other, to see how they fit together. Because they're not quick enough to comprehend them.
Are you saying that before the world has run its course, and we're talking about Armageddon, God has decided who will and who will not? Are numbers decided?
We're back to Calvinism again. And 144,000 are already due to be saved. Those statements are symbolic. Those that are to be saved are human beings. Yeah? They're not carrots or stones. They're not insensate blocks. They're human beings. Now, a human being is a technical term. Isn't that nothing? A being down at the level of physical body, pleasure, pain, serial mentation is not human. Right? So the election of grace is for those beings who comprehend. Right? And having comprehended, will to obey the comprehension, which puts them immediately in line with the purpose for which they were fabricated. Now, there's obviously at that level no difference between the will of the individual man and the will of the absolute for the individual man. And he is the elect. But it's perfectly obvious that if God wills to make reflexively self-conscious beings according to the words of Christ, is it not written, ye are gods? Every human being is a god. Now, do you elect yourself to be what you are, or do you prefer to go down?
Because every spirit coming into the time process that you were describing earlier on, that must be the beginning of their awareness of the necessity for the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
But what goes wrong? Is it nothing but inertia?
Well, what goes wrong? What goes wrong is focus on externality.
Yes, it's that.
Nothing else. There's no other mystery than this. The will is absolute internality. The intellect is a formal structure around it, and physicality is a further structure around that. So the moment you start looking at what you call the gross physical body, this thing, you're already, if you allow yourself to believe that it is there, apart from the intent of consciousness, fallen. To fall is quite simply to accept that as self-existent instead of posited by intelligence. Because the moment you believe that, you're as bad as an empirical scientist. In the pursuit of truth, you will get hold of it and saw it into little bits. And you will formulate an atomic theory. And your little bits will be in space. Space for you will be void. It won't be spirit. Actually, it's spirit. But it will be void, and the little parts of metal that you saw on that, you will call atoms, and you will have to say they're moving about fortuitously within space, because you have de-spiritualized space.
Spirit has no inertia then?
None at all. Spirit is immediate. Immediacy is the opposite of inertia.
At what point, in terms of the will, does the inertia start? At the point of willing to be
inertia. immediately after it, you posit the form. You posit the form. The will posits that body.
And inertia.
It throws it down.
It even does exist. It must become inertia.
No. Inertia means in work, doesn't it? There's a mysterious process in the will of the will. That process is catalytic and diabolic and down throwing. It throws the object down like that by looking at it. Just one wink of the eye. And then there's an object.
Yes.
An Augenblick.
But that moment that it sees that object, that inertia.
At the moment, it focuses on the object is inert.
Yes.
It has posited this inert object by looking at it. You do it in a Rorschach test, don't you?
Yes.
You get a bit of ink, you put it on foliage over. You look at it, it's a mad bull charging at you, if you're nervous. On the other hand, it's a striptease girl waving her veils. Who knows what it is? It is what you will it to be. That's the meaning of the Rorschach test. That it reveals your hidden motivation. But it isn't there, is it really? All that is really there, in the case of the Rorschach test, is a piece of paper with ink on it. But your intent. I imagine that not only is this Rorschach test what it looks like, and it wasn't accidental, it was a Rorschach chappy that utilized it and named it, that the universe itself is a Rorschach test. There is nothing there except vibrating infinite power, and each point of power vibrating interpenetrates with its waves all the others, and that's the hexonic field.
If you will anything,
you've lost
your will.
If you will anything, and forget you've willed it,
things,
it's forgetting.
Then you've lost your will.
You drink the waters of leaping. You shock yourself. You like that fellow that did a statue of a lady and fell in love with it. Or the other fellow that did a statue of a god and then fell down and worshipped it. It is possible to do that. I know a fellow that painted a picture of an African juju thing, put it on the wall and woke up in the middle of the nightmare and thought it was looking at him. It was so good. He'd done everything. He painted this picture to impress his friends. He put little lights along it. He got joss sticks and so on. Made the room smell nice. What was he doing it for? He was going to frighten his friends. He fell asleep. He opened his eyes. What was he doing? The candles were flickering. Was it smelling the same? Or was it beginning to smell like a juju? In his fuzzy brain, his original motivation was beginning to objectify. It's quite easy to hear that, isn't it? How many men that go about having been fed with muffins by a marvellous mum go around looking for the same shape and they see a rough approximation to it and they say, ah, the source of muffins. And suddenly they're slipping a ring on a finger. It's supposed to be on her finger. Why does she accept it? She knows if he puts it on in public, it's his. Some careless thinkers make him wear one as well. He doesn't need to. He's wearing it if that one don't matter. In the eyes of the public. And if he's looking for a muffin-type mum, certainly will not break out of the comprehensive grasp of society as a body, will he? So, the will posits, and it does it without doing anything. The very latest experiments in this investigation into processes inside the psyche show that something happens in an act of will which does not alter the pattern of the brainwave. It actually doesn't disturb an alpha rhythm, which is basic. So there's something there that is not energy in the ordinary physical sense. It is catalytic consciousness. Will does not mean releasing gross energy and pushing and urging. Will is a slight sparkle in the eye. Nothing else. Did you see Official 38 as a film years ago, Bob? About the Greek god Zeus coming to earth to seduce ladies. And it showed him in heaven. And before he came down to earth, he had a little pipette and he put divine sparkle in his eyes. Then he went down to earth. Whatever lady he did that to, they promptly started getting ready because of the eye sparkle. Now that eye sparkle was just a reference to this wunder out there, this fact that the consciousness of God, the infinite consciousness of God, is called a wonder eye because what does it do? It posits forms and wounds itself. Wonder and wounding are the same word. Because you posit this thing, it's a wound inside you. And it's wound round. And you wind the consciousness around it. You're okay, but you remember, I'm doing it. I am so fascinating. Fascinating means binding, doesn't it? And if you forget and say, what a marvellous thing, I wonder who made it. I'd better own it. Who's about? I'll treasure it. I'll put it in my safe account. It's so beautiful, I'll have to wrap it up so it doesn't get rusty and put it in the bank so it doesn't get lost. And I'll keep thinking about it. I know people who do that. I know one woman, the whole of her jewellery is in the bank. She hasn't worn it for 50 years. But she's thought about it every day. And another woman's got a mink coat, 3,000 quid. She wore it once to prove to me that she'd got it and then put it in the wardrobe. Good? Think of that self-fascination. And the woman with the mink is quite clever. She says, I know it's no good. I know it's only a mink. So I'm not really trapped. Not much. The whole art of all religion consists in this. Becoming aware that you posit your universe. Sounds silly, doesn't it? Looking from where I am, all you people are posited by the same consciousness which posits this body, the same consciousness. But all those different bodies are unique in their configurations externally and internally. And they're posited by this field, this non-dual field, posits all these different organisms. So they're absolutely non-different in essence, but absolutely unique in form and function. If I identify with the consciousness, all those organisms are mine. If I think they're not mine, but this one is, I'm fallen. Simple. Now, who's going to mind the baby tonight? If that is so, I could mind it. And so it should be, I could even let you mind it when I go to the pictures. And I wouldn't feel bad about it. Because there is only this supreme, non-dual, absolute sentient power which has made all these organisms. What's the good of kicking and biting and scratching? Can you imagine a little bunch of wavelets going along in the ocean, coming to another little bunch of wavelets and shouting, "Enemy!" and crashing into it and trying to smash it? What happens in such a case? That's a model of America and Vietnam, isn't it? Have they cured anybody? Have they changed anybody's mind? Have they dominated them? You mean the native sharpness that was in the beans,
yes,
under the stimulus has become more itself?
Yes?
Yes? So the most you could do for somebody would be to convince them that they are what they are.
Yes.
And you could never get them to kneel down and thank you for saving them and keeping the world free for democracy. So the otherness, the misconception that there is an other, a separate being, is a convenience for sharpening ourselves up. No, you haven't. You can't even guarantee that. At the moment of their annihilation, what has happened is their business. And you have to deal with them on the reincarnation. And if you knock them out too soon, they come back immediately. Often in your line instead of theirs. It is automatic that when a hero kills another being, he identifies with that being, and he has to do a penance.
So what happens then when you
Well, just think that when they were putting their viewpoint, they were apologizing. Didn't they say they dropped those things to defend their buddies?
Yeah.
They had to have an excuse. And they know inside themselves, in the will of the will, don't they, whether they would actually do for their buddy what they say for their buddy. Do they really do it for the buddy? There's a fellow napalm a little village because some so-called communist has just shot one of his friends. Is it true? Not at all, and he knows it. He knows that the depth of his being is riddled with ancestral rage and qualitatively reinforced by his rage against the limitations imposed on him by him, by accepting the restraints imposed on him by the society in which he lives. He knows that. Those men don't even sound as if they're telling the truth. How can they? The being internally knows what it is saying and why. It knows that it posits what it says by act of will. It knows that the reason it offers you in its pattern is an act of will. It knows the justification of it in serial conversation is an act of will. And it knows that the like and dislike that arise in it and the physical price to pay for it are the products of that act of will. That is the end of a process like a reflection of the old days of heroes, isn't it?
Yes.
Everything goes in cycles and things recur and recur and recur. So the Knights of the Round Table is like a repetition of some other knights long ago, isn't it?
Yes.
Like the Bushido in Japan or the great Mithras in ancient Persia. It's cyclic. And when that vanishes, it just shrinks down. It's still there as a seed because it has exhausted its significance for the time being. When we say, if you see a thing the first time, you don't know you've seen it. You see it for the second time, you have an image that says you might have seen it before. You see it for the third time, you verify it. In 100 years, there are roughly 3 generations. Each generation does this process. Posit something, not know that you've done it. Do it again and get a feeling of reminiscence. Do it the third time, you're sure about it. Start the next trio of generations, the next century. So that each century the concept changes. One would. You've only got one lifetime, that's the interesting thing. Yeah. Because your life is eternal. And you never, ever had for life anything other than here now. In eternity it was here now. In time you got here now. In every here now you posit something. If with it you reposit something you posited before in the here now in order to remember it, you complicate your here now in order to examine and compare. But you never had anything other than here now.
So what happened to the hierarchy then?
You mean the face hierarchy in the illusory time process?
Yeah.
It diminishes and vanishes and reappears again. Turn the Arthurian cycle, you see that the knights of the round table vanish, don't they? The king is killed. But it tells you he must come again, doesn't it? Arthur will reappear. Arthur is really Hathura, law. It is repetition. It always gives itself 12 disciplines, the signs of the zodiac, the 12 tribes, the 12 knights of the table. It's always the same process. The hierarchy appears, manifests, people look at it, decide whether they like it or not, and it goes down. Why does it go down? Because if it were presented to you and stayed there, you'd have no alternative but to accept it. It'd be an imposition. If it's offered to you and then shrinks and vanishes, you can make up your mind whether you wish to reposit it in you. Christ says this when he says, if I do not go, the Comforter cannot come. I have to remove myself before you will stand in an inner decision of your own. But when that decision is made by the individual's consciousness returns into that space and reposits itself again. Every child that sees a parent doing something efficiently will tend to copy that efficient act. And if the parent carries on doing that efficient act, the child will tend to keep copying the parent. But if having done that perfect act, the parent sees the child copy it, and then the parent does this week's deliberate mistake, what does the child say immediately? Mummy, you've done it wrong. Doesn't it? That's the beginning of the child positing it. And if at that moment the mother said, wrong, there's no such thing as wrong, the child would go into chaos. But if the act was right, and the mother says, thank you for that, I forgot about that, the child thinks, I remembered the right way. I educated mummy. He reinforces it. And the next time mummy does it right, the kid thinks, I'm the cause of her rightness. He's got another lesson to learn.
What did you say about the thing with the consciousness of the
Did you notice the inevitability in her face? As opposed to the crying child with one leg off. What was the child crying about? Why was the mother sitting there as if this kind of thing happens in war? But the child was crying. Why? It's not a bad analysis, is it?
Well, it took me out of it, and I thought, my God, they had the chance
to meet Well, didn't they go into minis and start collaborating? Perhaps you're looking at those legs and saying, this is what you get for fraternizing and liking it. Or it might have been something quite different. When you do an analysis like that, you have to be careful that you don't dogmatize. Supposing that when these two were put together, a woman with two legs off and a baby with one, supposing somebody said diddums to the baby and not to the mother. What do you think the child does? The absent leg has become a weapon. Isn't it? And how about the motivation of this woman that's lost her legs? What was her life like when she had a pair? Hard work. She was getting something. You see, it's highly complex. She might have thought, well, I deserve that for fraternizing. But she might not have thought that at all. She might have thought, legs off. No further work, heroism, perhaps even the grave. Perhaps she's a Buddhist, reincarnation. The complexity of her motivations, you cannot analyse except hypothetically, can you? Unless you talk to that woman individually, face to face, with really intimate cross-questioning. So that the solution that you come to and stick on has something to do with you. When you say this is the solution, you're really talking about yourself as you identify yourself in the situation. And you see how easy it is to fall. Something happens, and if you don't watch it, you take an attitude. And if you're not careful, you'll think the attitude is correct. You'll think that you have a right analysis, and then you've made the form. And you forget that you've posited the form, you've posited the analysis, you've made the right. But you go under the law governing the form with which you identify. So whatever you say about a thing, whatever analysis you give, if you stand there and say, this is the truth, immediately you start processes inside yourself to teach yourself a lesson. The ultimate is absolute freedom. His worship is perfect freedom, it says in the Bible. Perfect freedom. That is freedom gained reflexively. It's not any old freedom. You can imagine a state called free by changing the word free to unconditioned. Now imagine infinite power moving at random, which is conceivable, and imagine it with no conditions whatever upon it. Call that free. Now, is it perfect? Can't be. Because perfect means realized factually in reason, and the reason realized factually. His worship is perfect freedom. That is to say, freedom. Self-poverting, self-limitation, self-formulation, factually realized. Hegel's idea, the real is the rational is the real, would have been perfect if he had said, and this real, rational, rational, real is posited by a will which is absolute, which is free, and which is in the individual that it posits exactly to the same degree it is in itself. And then that would have meant that instead of being pawns in the system, every human being would have been God again. Now you're changing the meaning of the word one life to one temporal life in one body. You must be doing. Because if there's only one life, that doesn't mean that that one life can't mask itself in millions of ways, does it?
No.
You can pull faces that you haven't pulled before.
Well, you can tell in the life of the death life story.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you saying now? You come in at the birth point, you're referring to time, aren't you?
Yes.
So you're talking about temporal life.
Time is
an eternity. Now, if you had only one temporal life, then anything you saw, you'd be seeing for the first time, wouldn't you?
I don't
mean so you must be positing yourself before birth as already existent. So then you'd be agreeing possibly with Plato that you've already seen everything before you enter time.
Yes.
So it wouldn't be surprising if you recognised some of it.
No.
That simple resonance.
Yes.
But then this deja vu concept, I've already seen it. There's another explanation possible. When you look at a thing, you can actually feed it back into your brain, like that within a split second, so that you see it twice. Although you've never seen it before in time, you've seen it twice now. You send the message through the brain, you send it round twice without noticing, and you have a sensation of recognition through immediate feedback. You think you've seen it before in time, and you haven't.
Mm.
You've seen it by immediate feedback. That also is an explanation. If you come down on any finite explanation about anything, you're fallen again. It's absolutely essential to recognize that. Dogmatism is for dogs. That's not a joke. A dogma is for believing. Doggies are called Fido. Fido, I believe. A dogma is formulated by an intelligence to keep in order those that can be kept in order by a fixated opinion. It hasn't got any other use. It's for the unfree to keep them tidy.
Yes.
That's right. Beware of pity, said Nietzsche. What would pity do for you if you had it?
Mm-hmm.
So it would be regressive. Pity is one of the worst poisons in the world. Self-pity, conscious self-pity, is worse, isn't it? Because that's negative feedback of the lowest order. You can't get lower than self-pity. Somebody else pitying you, you can think, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's useful to let him pity me because maybe he'll give me a banana. But if you do it yourself, that's really the bottom.
But how do you differentiate between dogma and the teachings of
Well, a dogma is something you mustn't analyze. The dogma is laid down for you by the priestcraft, not to be thought about. You take this on trust and you must not analyze it. That's the essence of a dogma. You are not to break it down. The priest has made it for you and you are not to fiddle about with it. For instance, the mystery of the Trinity. Don't think about it. Just take it. That's a dogma. If you say, here is a statement. God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. The Father is power, and the power itself is the will of the Absolute, which we can talk about, feel for, but in itself, the will of the will, we cannot verbalize. The Son of that Father is the formulation made by the will for its own self-objectification. The Holy Ghost is the functionalizing of that precipitated form by the power of the will that precipitated the form. These three, simultaneously, co-present, mutually interpenetrating, not to be confounded or mixed together, and not to be substantially divided, constitute a meaning which, if you think about it, analyze it, break it down, reassemble it as many times as you like, you will enrich yourself progressively, and you will find out that you are the temple of the living God. Because when you use your intellect, if there is a truth in it, like a triangle has three sides, that truth belongs to God the Son, because God the Son is the form of truth posited by the Father. If there is a function, like waving or something else, or writing a book, whatever the function is, it is a function which is nothing but the dynamized, serialized, kinetic movement of the power formulating. And the will to do it is the generative Father of it. And this is as true for you as it is for God. So if you want to go and worship in the cellar, or up a ladder, or swimming in the sea every morning, whatever you do, posited by your will, formulated by you, functionalized by you, it is an absolute right and a divine act for you to do it.